Welcome to Focused on Life, where we'll be laser focused on all things that have to do with defending human dignity, human rights, and yes, human life at every stage and phase of development. I am your host, Uju.
And I am your other host, Matt.
And we are thrilled to be here today. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Uju. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. Just enjoying the summer, as brief as the rest of it might be. But I'm just having a great time this summer. I've just come back from a speaking engagement in the United States. I went to Minnesota and I had the privilege of keynoting at the Wonder 24 conference. And Wonder 24 conference is an event that is organized, at least for now, every 2 years by the Word on Fire Ministries, or Word on Fire Institute, which is part of Word on Fire Ministry. So yeah, I'm kind of on a really high note here, and enjoying everything. And today, I'm glad that we're recording an episode.
I'm glad we're back recording. Like you said, it's been quite a summer. Yeah. And I have to, you know, we're always kind of competing with each other. And I came back. We were just, I was with a few of my colleagues in the province of New Brunswick not too long ago. And we were doing these small pro-life forums. And, you know, and you and I were talking before this recording. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, I spoke to, there was 10 people at one and then 25 at another event. And then meanwhile, you're like, well, you know, I was speaking to about 1,500 people. And I'm like, okay, you win, Uju, win.
But the one thing I know, Matt, is whether if you're doing anything along the lines of like pro-life, you know, evangelization, you know, any of these things where you have to go out and share the good news, share the gospel, be it the gospel, or the gospel of life, as Pope St. John Paul II would say, even if you're speaking to 1,500 people, whether you are speaking to 100 people, 18 people, or yeah, 4 people who kind of turn up, it's all worth it. Yeah,
all
the speech I gave in Minnesota to, you know, 1,200 people it was, I would give it to a gathering of 4 people, if only they say, come and tell us about this, you know, come and tell us more about what, you know, this thing that you keep talking about, neocolonialism, or, you know, talk to us about pro-life topic. I would do it if 4 people invite me to do it. I would do it if 1,200 people invite me to do it. So
yeah, I mean, I think that's every opportunity we have to speak, even just one-on-one conversations,
yeah,
I think are huge. And today, on today's episode, we will be having a one-on-one conversation. Well, I mean, there's 3 of us, but we're having an amazing, amazing guest on this podcast episode. We're dedicating this whole episode to chemical abortions. RU486, which is kind of the historical term for chemical abortions. Nowadays, they're called medicine abortion or medical abortion
or
medical termination. You know, they're also, you know, making it not sound positive, but really what it is killing a human being, a baby inside the womb through a 2-pill combo of drugs. Correct?
Absolutely. Mife and miso, as they call them.
That's
but,
it.
Yeah, but I'm looking forward for, you know, to discussing this with our next guest, who you're to introduce.
I'm going to introduce in just 1 second. But before we do that, before we bring our guest on the show, why are we talking about chemical abortions? Well, we were just talking recently about the rates of chemical abortions all around the world. You know, in the United States, I just read the Guttmacher Institute. It just released data that more than 60% of abortions are chemical nowadays. That's across the United States of America. In Canada, I think we're about half. I may be wrong on that, but in the UK, Uju, it's similar.
Quite significant, very similar. I mean, we've even seen statistics where something like 80 or 90% in some places.
In some places,
in Europe, where the abortions are now really essentially chemical abortion or medical abortions. So it's one part of defending life that I think we need to pay more attention to. We need to pay more attention to because it's growing as a monster, it's a giant. Yes, I know that a lot of us go outside abortion clinics, pray outside abortion clinics, and we're praying to even meet or interface with one woman working in there. But a lot of those are for surgical abortions. These days, abortion is something that is happening now between a woman, her boyfriend, and the pharmacist. Sometimes it's just a woman, her boyfriend, and the postman, for places where they are bringing it into the homes by post. So it's something I think more pro-life people should think about more, pray about more, and learn more about. So yes, our next guest is going to tell us a lot about chemical abortions.
Dr. Dermot Carney is a consultant, cardiologist, and former president of the Catholic Medical Association in the UK. He obtained a medical degree from UCD in Dublin, Ireland in 1989. Following general medical and cardiology specialist training in Ireland, Dr. Carney completed a fellowship in interventional cardiology in the Netherlands. He's had a long career in medicine and more recently has been a leading proponent of abortion pill reversal. And because of his pro-life advocacy and work in saving lives, he's had some difficulty, and we'll get to that in just a bit. Dr. Dermot, it's an honor to have you on Focus on Life podcast today. Thank you for being here with us.
It's lovely. It's lovely to be here with both you and Matt and
Thank
with
you.
Uju. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Wow, we're so grateful to have you here, Dr. Dermot. But I think for this podcast, you're okay for us to call you Dermot, right? I
Of
know some
course, yeah,
people,
that's my
yeah.
name.
In some places, I know people be like, "Oh, it's a doctor." Just always put I want that honor. But Dermot, thank you so very much for doing this with us today. Now, I first came across you, I believe, on X. Well, then it used to be Twitter, and I had heard about this doctor who had come into some difficulty really in the UK here where I'm residing, of course, where you're residing as well. And wow, reading about you, seeing some of the things you were going through at the time, which we're going to go into in a little bit, I was really moved and quite inspired. So later on, of course, when we started the podcast, and then Matt said, "Oh, how about this doctor? I found this Irish doctor in the UK." I'm like, I know of him, and I have heard so much about him. So what an honor really it is for you to be speaking with us today on Focused on Life podcast. Well, first of all, Matt has done an excellent introduction of you, but it that you know that's the kind of bio that we see online, that's the bio that we use at events. Can you tell us in your own words a little bit about you as a doctor, or what you would what how you would want us to know you really as Dr. Dermot Kearney, your practice in medicine, and how you came to be this person that is really sought after in pro-life circles, for speeches and things like that.
Yes, it's very much by accident. Thank you for that very kind introduction as well. As Matt said, I did my basic training in cardiology and in cardiology and in general medicine, and then did some extra specialist training in the Netherlands. Once I decided that that was the area of medicine I was going to practice in,
Right.
I had intended just to work as a cardiologist. I wasn't a member of any particular organizations. I wasn't. Well, I was always pro-life at heart. It never was an issue in Ireland because growing up we didn't have abortion, we didn't have divorce, we didn't have any major issues that were outside of Catholic tradition, Catholic teaching. So none of
Right.
these issues were very. I never thought that any of them would ever be an issue. There was something I was going to have to become involved in. I came to the
Exactly.
UK almost by accident because I had intended to go back to Ireland, but at that time, after I finished my training in the Netherlands, wasn't there was there were no real there was very few cardiology jobs or positions available in Ireland. So the next day I came across an opportunity to work in one of the hospitals in the north of England, and when I saw one of my colleagues who I trained with in Ireland, so I rang him up and he said, "Oh yeah, come over and have a look," because they were recruiting
Okay.
cardiologists at the time. That's how I ended up coming here. Again, I wasn't involved in any particular organizations. My intention was to just do pure cardiology and keep my head down and work hard and get on with life. However, that changed in one day when I was in a clinic setting, and a patient hadn't turned up, so I had a few minutes with nothing to do, and I was looking around and I saw a notice on the board, and it was a list of procedures that were done in the hospital I was working in. At the bottom of the list, it said termination of pregnancy, and I almost collapsed. I never realized till that moment that I was working in a hospital where abortions were being carried out,
Wow.
and I said, "I'm going to have to do something about this now." I knew you can't just go up to people and say, "Sorry, you can't do these anymore." That there was These things are deeply ingrained in British society.
For
But I
sure.
decided I was going to have to at least try to raise the issues in conversation. So I decided the best place to start was with young doctors, medical students, and without, obviously, I'm not allowed to put pressure on people or to try to pressurize people into to following what I would believe. But I wanted to say, because it's an issue, or these are issues that people don't talk about in the UK, even
Yeah.
though deep down everybody has an opinion, but they're not prepared to talk about it
That's
very
right. Yeah.
unless it's actually brought forward to their attention. So I started just in casual conversation with some of the doctors, okay, who were working with us. Okay, what are their long-term plans? What do they hope to do after they finish whatever training they were doing with us? And if they said they were going to go into obstetrics or general practice, I thought, oh, here's an opportunity. I said, oh, that's
Okay.
wonderful. There's a great need for doctors in these areas. Will you have any worries or any ethical concerns? The majority of them said, no, it's no problem at all. But a small number did. Someone say, yes, I'm really, because I'm a Catholic, or I'm a Christian, or I'm a Muslim, or sometimes they didn't even say any particular religious people, said, but I'm a bit worried about, I don't really want to have to be involved in doing abortions.
Right.
So I took that opportunity to educate them, because there is a belief, or I suppose a lack of understanding, lack of knowledge among a lot of junior doctors who think they've got no options in these things. They don't know the law, they don't know what they're entitled to. So I made it a point
True.
that for any time I came across younger doctors, to at least make them aware that there were certain things that went against their conscience, they did not have to be involved in.
Okay.
They did have to inform. They couldn't enforce their beliefs on others or on patients, but they didn't have to be involved with it. And they could say, oh, I'm afraid I can't do that because of whatever reason, or even for no obvious reason. But you are entitled to talk to another doctor about that. So, and a few of them over the years have come back to me to thank me for that, especially actually the people most grateful are Muslims, who tend to back. I was working in a general practice. A girl came, she said she wanted an abortion, and I didn't know what to do. But I remember you
Right.
told me that I was entitled to say that, sorry, I can't do that, but you're entitled to see one of the other doctors about that. So a few of them did come back with that. So that was what got me involved initially.
Okay.
Then on one occasion in 2008,
Yes.
I remember well, because I'd just been to Lourdes. It was my first trip ever to Lourdes. It was the 150th anniversary of the Lourdes apparitions, and I'd just come back, and I was full of the spirit. And
Amazing.
a young doctor from Poland, and she doesn't mind, because she said that, I'm not going to name her, but she says she doesn't mind me telling her story.
Okay.
I had heard that she had been pressurized. She was on call. She had qualified in Poland, had come to the UK to do basic training, and then wanted to become a family doctor, general practitioner.
GP, yeah, okay.
She had to go on a training scheme, and our very first position on the GP training scheme was in a Nower hospital, and it was in obstetrics. Our very first weekend on call, the nurses said to her, oh, would you mind just writing up the drugs for that young girl who's having the termination in the morning?
Wow.
And she said, I'm sorry, no, I can't do that. I'm Catholic. And the nurses were astounded, but they thought maybe it's a language thing, maybe they didn't understand. So she said,
Okay.
oh, no, you don't have to give the drugs. We'll give the drugs, but you just have to write them up. And she
Wow.
said, oh, no, I can't be complicit in any way. And they were absolutely astonished. They had never come
Heard
across
it
any.
before. Wow.
But they said, but if you don't do it, there's nobody else. We're going to have to call in the consultant, and he's not going to be pleased. This was a Sunday evening. And they
Yeah.
did. They called in the consultant, and he shouted at her on the ward in front of patients and nurses, that she said, people like you should not be allowed to work in this country. Now, he had no right to say that. That was against the law. He could have been
Of
sacked.
course.
Now, and she was in tears, but she stood firm, and she didn't do what they want her to. So he had to do whatever
Yeah.
bribing was
Yeah.
necessary. But a few days, that was Sunday. Wednesday, he called her into his office, and he apologized. He said he was very sorry. He knew he was out of order. He shouldn't have said what he said. Now, somebody may have told him, hey, you were very hard on that young man.
Yeah, out of order
But when
completely.
I heard that story, and I heard it firsthand from her, I said, that poor girl, she came to this country. She did not know if there was any other Catholics in the hospital. She didn't know, even if there was, would they support her? Was she going to
Yes.
be deported on the next plane back to Poland? So courageous. I said, there must be some organization that is around to support people in
The
this situation.
support.
I ran up to my office. I put up this where I'm sitting now at the moment. I typed in on the computer Catholic Doctors Associations, and eventually I came across the Catholic Medical Association, and I joined it that same week.
Wow.
The rest is history. But again, it was mainly because the Catholic Medical Association is to help Catholics, but also people of other persuasions
Yes.
abide by their conscience while still providing excellent medical
Excellent
service.
medical care. Yes.
Don't have to compromise your conscience to do good for people and to give appropriate care.
Yeah.
So that's our aim. And we help mainly Catholics, but sometimes non-Catholics and Muslims and people who don't have any particular religion come to us and ask us, for some advice or some help with some ethical dilemmas that they might have.
Right.
I got involved eventually in pro-life activities again by accident because I
Yeah.
became a member of council, because I was very dedicated to the CMA and I set up a branch in the area here where I'm
And
working.
what does the CMA stand for? The Catholic Medical
Catholic
Association?
Medical
Yeah.
Association.
Okay,
The
that's
oldest,
it.
but the oldest Catholic medical association in the world, at least the oldest surviving.
No
There was
doubt,
a
yeah.
French one before us. Well, we were formed in 1911. There had been a French one beforehand, but they had disbanded during the First World War and then rejoined again. And so we're the longest continuous surviving Catholic Medical Association in the world. And we do, I think we do a lot of good work for Catholics working
Yeah. Okay.
for our patients as well. But in 2014, at one of our council meetings, a wonderful man called Jack Scarisbrack, who founded LIFE, the pro-life organization LIFE.
Right, okay.
And he came to us and he said that women were coming to him and to his organization. They had taken the first abortion pill. I know
Okay.
we'll talk about abortion in a moment.
Yes.
And they had heard that there might be some way to try and prevent abortion from progressing if they got some antidote to the abortion pill that they'd taken before
Right.
Christmas. We knew nothing about this. We'd never heard. We knew about medical abortions or chemical abortions, but we were not aware that there was a way that they could be reversed or prevented. So we were a bit skeptical. And he said, no, I've heard that if you use progesterone, and we said, well, that makes sense because mifepristone blocks progesterone. Maybe if you give progesterone, well, we were still very skeptical. We thought, well, first of all, is there a need? Or do women really change their mind? And I've since learned that many of them do. Then the second our concern was, well, even if they change their mind, we know that this abortion pill is very potent. So is it? It's probably too late. Even if they get the progesterone, it's not going to make any difference. But that, no, that. Well, we said we'd look into it. Our biggest concern, however, was safety because we were thinking even if the baby did survive, was there going to be a chance that there would be some severe congenital problems? Because we were thinking of thalidomide and other drugs which are no, known to be teratogenic. So if this baby has been exposed to mifepristone early in pregnancy and now manages somehow to survive, either by luck or by progesterone, what are going to be the consequences of that little child if he or she happens to be born alive? And that was our main concern. So, well, we said we'd look into it. There wasn't a lot of information in 2014. There was very little because the actual abortion pill service had only started in the US 2 years before that, and they only had small numbers of cases. However, I saw an interview with a doctor called George Delgado on a television program, EWTN, I think. Oh, yeah, that sounds promising. I better look more into this. So I started to read, and eventually in 2018, another pro-life organization called Good Counsel and their leader, their president, Claire, was her name Claire? Claire from Dublin.
It's Claire. Yeah, it's Claire something. I know her. I know her, but
I think of the
yeah,
name.
I don't remember her surname off the top of my head.
She came to our CMA annual conference and pleaded with us because they were said they were getting more and more young women coming to them who deeply regretted they'd taken the first abortion pill and there was nowhere else they could turn to. They had tried going to some Harley Street private doctors and they were charging a fortune for doing blood tests and ultrasound scans and that. And she wondered, being a benevolent organization like ourselves, would the Catholic Medical Association please, please help? So I promised Claire that I would go to the CMA in the US and meet the pioneers of the abortion pill reversal. So in 2018, I went to the CMA conference, met George Delgado and a number of other people who were actively involved in abortion pill reversal. And when we came back, then we agreed at our council meeting that yes, this was something that we knew at this stage it was safe, we knew it was often effective, and we knew that there was desperately a need for. So we decided we would try to establish an abortion pill reversal service in the UK, which
And
we
this was around 2014, you
to
say.
2018 eventually. So 2014, we
2018
first heard,
eventually. Okay.
and more and more information over the next year. Then, 2018, we eventually decided yes, we're going to go ahead. Didn't know how to
Okay.
do it. It was 20 another 2 years before we got things actually up and running. I have to thank my colleague, Eileen Riley, who's an obstetrician in Glasgow. She was the first person to prescribe abortion pill reversal in this country. And that came about by accident because she had registered with the Abortion Pill Reversal Network, which are based in Columbus, Ohio. And that came about by a phone call that she got from a colleague in Ireland, because a number of doctors in Ireland had already registered with that service. And what happens is the girl will find this helpline in desperation. She'll ring the number, it'll be an American helpline. They will look to see do they have any doctors on their books registered with them who they can trust and they know will follow the protocols. And they had people in Ireland. They didn't have anybody in the UK at that stage. But a girl from England, the south of England, rang. And Americans, maybe Canadians, the same. They probably don't know the difference between Ireland and England. I think it's all this, it's over there. It's the same country. But so they rang this doctor in Ireland, and he said, "I'm really sorry. I'm only registered to practice and prescribe within the Republic of Ireland, but I know someone that I've worked with in the UK, and I'll ask her if she might be." And he contacted Eileen Riley, and that's how Eileen got involved. She registered. She told me about it. This is how we're going to do it. So I registered with the Abortion Pill Reversal Service in America. So most of our calls, about 80, 85 to 90% of our calls come through the Abortion Pill Reversal Helpline. Small numbers still come through organizations such as Society for Protection of Unborn Children, Good Counsel, the Christian Concern. I've had a few from a number and some of the other pro-life pregnancy centers that are around the country. So we've had small numbers have come through to us through them, but the majority come through the Abortion Pill Reversal Helpline.
Okay, so at this point, I know you've kind of taken quite the scenic route, I think, just telling us necessarily how you've come to be here today, how you've come to this particular part of your practice where we're now talking about abortion pill reversal. But as I had told you earlier, I had heard about you because there was a particular case, a legal matter that was, or a particular investigation that was being carried out by the, I think it was the GMC, the General Medical Council here in the UK. So of course, I myself work in the NHS in the UK as well. So of course, it was of interest to me, and I'm pro-life. So I really wanted to know because I had never previously had never had I heard of a doctor who was courageous enough to stand, tall enough, practicing, this kind of pro-life medicine, if you like life-saving intervention to reverse an abortion that had already started. Until I heard about you. And now you've said, of course, yeah, there are probably a few other doctors who are doing the same thing. So if you would like to tell me just briefly, what happened with the GMC? What happened with the GMC? I think it
Yeah,
was 2021.
so myself and Dr. Eileen Riley, at the time, I think we were the only two providing the abortion pill reversal. We'd registered, and initially the numbers were slow, but eventually I was getting up to six calls a week sometimes. And not all of the girls went ahead with the treatment. Some of them decided for various reasons, usually due to coercion from boyfriends or husbands, that they'd like to save the baby, but really they couldn't because their boyfriend would leave them or whatever. But about two-thirds of them, about 60%, did actually start treatment. And we were doing this very happily. We were trying to promote it, actually. We weren't, some said we were keeping it under the radar, but it was the very opposite. I actually spoke at a parliamentary committee meeting in March 2021. They asked me to talk about the dangers with abortion pills. That was the primary thing that was under the discussion. But I said, "Oh, while you're on, would you tell us a little bit about what you're doing with this abortion pill reversal?" So I happily told them, and they got lots of questions from peers and MPs on, how many babies have been saved and so on. Because a number of babies had already been born at that stage. And then the ironic thing is that I was actually a part of a General Medical Council forum because I was the president of the Catholic Medical Association at the time. And the GMC had set up this Equality, Diversity, Inclusion Forum to show that there was no discrimination within among sort of minority groups within among doctors from the GMC. So they wanted to create this image that we love all our minority groups and all the faith groups, Catholics, Christians, Muslims, Jews, LGBT people, doctors, disabled doctors, women doctors, surgeon women doctors, all sorts of groups, African doctors. We were all invited to attend. And at each meeting, there was about three or four meetings a year, we had to give a little account of what our activities were. And at the early April 2021, I gave an account of abortion pill reversal. I said a number of our doctors, I didn't say how many or who, I provide this abortion pill reversal, and I told them the statistics of the babies that have been saved. At the end, they said, "Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you very much, Dr. Carney." And then we moved on to the
Oh,
next one. The GMC knew about this. This was early April, the end of April, 28th of April. Myself and Eileen Riley at the same time got an email from the GMC to say that they had received serious complaints from Mary Stopes International and the Royal College of Obstetricians, Gynecologists, the RCOG, that we were involved in providing an abortion pill reversal and that this possibly was professional misconduct and that it was possible. And there was 10 allegations against me. There was Because Eileen was an obstetrician, there was her allegations were slightly different, but the nuts and bolts was that we were possibly providing and imposing our pro-life views on these vulnerable women. The Royal College of Obstetricians letter actually, they specifically said, "We're not so much concerned about the treatment, it's the people involved. One of them is the president of the Catholic Medical Association and therefore cannot be trusted to provide non-judgmental appropriate treatment to these vulnerable women." So they were picking out because I was a Catholic that I could not be trusted to provide a treatment to women in pregnancy. Now, we obviously, CMA, Catholic Medical Association, came to the GMC about that specific issue, but it was just brushed under the carpet. Said, "Oh, they didn't take it seriously." Anyway. But anyway, there was these allegations. So we had to go to a tribunal 2 weeks later on the 12th of May, 2021. I was represented by, because within 2 days I had to inform the pro-life organizations that we weren't allowed to do this anymore, that this we had to put a halt to it because we were getting some calls from them. So I had to inform them. And Christian Concern, a wonderful organization based in London, and their CEO, their chief person, Andrea Williams, organized within 2 days a meeting, a Zoom meeting with myself, Dr. Riley, and two of her leading barristers who work for the Christian Legal Centre. And she they decided that they were going to defend us. Now, Eileen decided to go with a secular defense group as she was advised. I think maybe not wisely, but she went with a secular group. I went with Christian Concern. I trusted them and they were wonderful. And within a couple of days, they already had an expert witness who supported my side of the story, even though he's not a Catholic, he's not a Christian. He does abortions. He's an eminent obstetrician. He does abortions, but he's looked at the allegations and he thought this is ridiculous. There was absolutely nothing wrong. He thought there was a reasonable evidence base for what we were doing because we were charged of providing a treatment that had no evidence base. It was unethical, it was unlicensed. And he said, "None of that's true. It's not unethical. There is an evidence base. It's licensed. It's an off-license use." What they didn't, because that was the one of the complaints from Mary Stopes, that we were using an off-license medication. They said unlicensed, but they meant off-license. That means it's licensed. Progesterone is used. It's been used for 50, 60 years in pregnancy, but it's not licensed abortion reversal. But what they
Yeah, but
neglect
in the
is
UK, Dermot, in the UK, we do use quite a bit of off-license medications and medicines.
in gynecology and pediatrics.
Yeah, we do.
But what they didn't mention is that misoprostol, the second abortion, is also an off-license. That wasn't licensed. It is now in the last 12 months, 18 months. At that time, it wasn't licensed for use in abortion. Methotrexate, which is used for inflammatory conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, it's commonly used and highly recommended by the Royal College of Obstetricians for the medical management of ectopic pregnancies, and it's not licensed for that indication at all. So to say that we were using something off license and there was some of the problem has been inconsistent, if not hypocritical. So we looked at all the allegations and we on the track maybe we went to the tribunal. The GMC, unfortunately, they supported all the allegations. They upheld them, and they wanted they couldn't make the decision. The decision had to be made by the tribunal, which is an independent medical practitioners tribunal, although closely related to the GMC. So the GMC demanded that we that both Dr. Riley and myself would be suspended completely from medicine for 18 months. That was the maximum penalty that could be imposed, and then it would be reviewed every 6 months after that. But they wanted 18 months complete suspension. Now this was during COVID, and the tribunal thought that was probably a bit disproportionate because there were no complaints from any patients about us in any areas in any of our practice at all. So they thought that might be a bit harsh. So they decided to suspend us from providing the abortion reversal service, but we could still do. I could still do my cardiology and my general medicine. Eileen could still do her obstetrics, but with conditions of that, she had to be everything she did had to be done under supervision, which was really humiliating for an experienced, excellent obstetrician that you had to go to someone probably junior to herself and say, "This is what I've done. Have a look at it." I had to. The main condition for me was that I was not allowed to prescribe administer or recommend progesterone for abortion pill reversal. I wasn't allowed to do any private work or any voluntary, which I don't do any private work. I did some voluntary work. I used to go to Lourdes, as I mentioned, with sick people, but I wasn't allowed to do that unless I had express written permission from the GMT. So we were banned, and I thought that was it. But Christian Legal Centre, Christian Concern, decided no, they were going to appeal this. So we got together, as well as having the expert witness, we got lots of women that we had helped that had contacted me. So they came voluntarily to me. I didn't go looking for them. They approached me through whatever agency they chose. It was their choice, and I explained the situation to them. Two-thirds of them decided to go ahead with treatment. Some of them stopped it after a day or two, again, for various reasons.
Right.
Those who did continue, our success rate was about 55%, so, which is this is the real important thing about abortion pill reversal that I wanted to get across. That if a mother in pregnancy, in early pregnancy, takes both abortion pills, mifepristone, which basically causes detachment of the developing placenta from the lining of the womb, so it cuts off the nutrient supply to the baby, so no oxygen, no nutrients, so the baby starves and suffocates. Because of lack of nutrient supply, so it prevents the development of the placenta basically. If she takes the first drug but and takes the second drug, which she's meant to take 1 or 2 days later, called misoprostol, that's a prostaglandin that it causes a contraction of the uterus and expels the baby, the developing baby, and the other products of conception. So the abortion is complete, in not always complete, mind you, but 96, 97, 94, 95% of cases will be complete. Six or seven would be incomplete and would have to have a surgical abortion, but 98 to 99% of the babies will die. So she takes both abortion pills. There's a 98 to 99% chance her baby will not survive. And the very few who do survive, the majority are then killed by surgical abortions afterwards or further medical abortions. If she takes the first abortion pill, mifepristone, but doesn't, for whatever reason, take the second abortion pill, either she's changed her mind or she can't get it or she loses it or whatever. If she doesn't take the abortion, second abortion pill, but if she doesn't get progesterone, there's about a 20% chance her baby will survive. So there's about an 80% guaranteed mortality rate for if she just takes the one pill, the mifepristone, 20% survival. Depends on the stage of gestation, but in general, about a 20% survival rate. If she takes the first abortion pill, doesn't take the second abortion pill, but if she manages to get sufficient dose of progesterone promptly, so ideally within 24 hours, but even up to 72 hours, it's worth giving if she hasn't had major bleeding and major cramps at that stage.
Right.
There's a 55% chance plus that the baby will survive. Now, in the US, survival rate has been found to be about 65%. The reason for that is, first of all, they've got quicker access. There's greater awareness, so they get treatment very quickly. Whereas here, our mean time is about 25 hours before we can start treatment after they've taken the pill. And secondly, in most cases in the US, they have the luxury of performing an ultrasound scan, so they can check, is the baby still viable or is he already dead? We don't have that, so we're given the treatment on good faith that hopefully the baby hasn't died yet, but in some cases we know that the demise has already occurred. So we don't know that until we get a scan done. So we get a scan done usually 2, 3, 4 days later, occasionally even later than that. So we give the treatment on good faith, hoping against hope that maybe the baby will survive. And if there hasn't been major bleeding, major cramps, there is a reasonable chance, at least 55% chance the baby will survive.
Okay.
So that's the really important thing that we need. So we more than double the survival rate.
Yes.
And there's work in the NHS. You should probably know there's very, very few interventions in medicine that has such a high level of success. Because if you take any condition where there's a guaranteed mortality of 80%, and you
That's
can
right.
reduce that down to less than 50%,
Yeah.
that's a significant risk reduction of more than 30%.
Yeah.
And we get excited in cardiology if there's a risk reduction of 10%, 15%. We
Yeah,
think
so
it's a wonderful
this
drug.
is meant to be exciting. In other
Yeah,
words, this
30,
is meant to
35,
be,
40%.
yeah.
So
I think personally the pioneers of this, George Delgado, Matthew Harrison, the people who discovered this work, they should be up for a Nobel Prize for medicine
But
because
they're
this
not
is.
gonna, nobody's gonna give them that, not in the
No, you're
world
right.
we
I'll
live
nominate them.
at
You
this
know what?
point,
I will.
yeah.
I think Uju, you and I will write the first letter for their nomination. No, but
Honestly.
Dr. Dermot, I was you actually beat me to my next question because I was going to ask you to explain exactly how the chemical abortion, the two pill combination works. You've done that. And you've also explained my follow-up question, which is how exactly does the abortion pill reversal work? And with the use of progesterone. So essentially, progesterone is, it's not like a miracle drug. It's used for other things as well. I know personally, when my wife was pregnant with, I think three out of, we have four boys. So three out of, maybe it was all of our sons, actually, I forget. But she had very low progesterone in her first trimester of pregnancy. So her doctor suggested that she get progesterone. And she did that. And I mean, the babies are alive. They were born. We didn't have any miscarriages, but that was one of the potential risks that if a baby is if there's not enough progesterone, then there could be a potential miscarriage. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. And so one of the leading causes of early miscarriage is low progesterone levels. And so then in a way that's what the abortion pill is the abortion pill that they gave the mifepristone. That's it's mimicking a low progesterone state. So it doesn't reduce the level of progesterone, but it does, it blocks the effect of the progesterone. So progesterone is a steroid hormone, and hormones generally work their magic, their influence in the body, all hormones, not only progesterone. Through interaction with receptors. So there's interaction with receptors. Receptors sets off a whole combination of other chemical reactions that happen. So if the progesterone, if the molecules can't connect with the receptor, then they can't have the effect. So it's the equivalent as if the level of progesterone is very low, because you're just not allowing progesterone that is actually there. You're not allowing it to have its effect. You're blocking the effect of it. So it's a receptor antagonist of progesterone. That's what mifepristone. All we're doing is we're trying to do what your wife went through, to try and reestablish sufficient levels of progesterone and progesterone effect to maintain the pregnancy, because progesterone is essential. That's what it's called. Progesterone means progestational steroid hormone. So progesterone is so it's essential for maintaining pregnancy.
I didn't know that. That's great. Matt, we're
Yeah.
learning
Yeah, we are
here.
learning. I had no idea. I had no idea.
Progestational. Oh, this is great. This is why you
Yes.
should get it. This is why you
But
should bring
it's,
on more doctors.
for someone like me, and I'm the furthest thing from a doctor, but when my wife, when we were going through this in the first our first pregnancies, and then she was getting the progesterone in her first trimester, it just made sense. The doctor explained it to us and it made sense. Okay, let's go for it. So then when I started learning about abortion pill reversal, and then I learned that it's essentially what you just described, doctor, that it's we're trying to I guess pump in more progesterone into the pregnancy, because that's what that first pill does. It kind of it's not reduct it doesn't reduce it, but it just mimics
The effect, it blocks the effect of
it blocks the effects of it. So then I thought to myself, well, this abortion pill reversal, it's like the most obvious thing that you would do in this situation. It's common sense. It's basic knowledge. It's nothing. It's not some sort of extraordinary thing that is happening in the medical world. It's a very common practice. So then I could not believe the amount of hatred and kind of like the accusations that this is, it's not scientifically, there's no scientific evidence. It's misinformation. It doesn't work, when clearly it does work. And you have colleagues in the medical field who also affirm this, that this is a good solution. It's not extraordinary. It's a very common thing that you can do. It's a simple thing you can do. And like you mentioned, doctor, it reduces the potential death rate by significantly, right? So, I can't believe the amount of, I guess, hostility and just kind of like this cancel culture that you experienced, that you and your colleagues experienced, because of something that you were doing that is very normal.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Just going on that, the thing that influenced me, because as I said, when we were first approached about this, we didn't know much about it. So we read the articles, and there were some things in favor of it, and we saw that there was some people against this. Couldn't understand why, as you've elaborately, beautifully expressed there. But the thing that the article that impressed me the most, actually, was surprisingly, a lot of people find this hard to understand, but 2017, I came across an article. I came across the following year, 2018, but it was published 2017 in the New York Times. And the New York Times is not well known for its pro-life sort of stance, I think. But there was a very, very well-balanced, well-written article I gave both sides of the story in one of their New York Times magazines. Can't remember the writer, but it was very good because she interviewed George Delgado. She also interviewed one of the main opponents to it. She interviewed one of the girls who'd had a baby having had the treatment. But the person that she interviewed that impressed me the most was a guy called Professor Harvey Kleiman, who is professor of reproductive health and placental research in Yale Medical School. That's a pretty niche area. So I felt he's the guy
That
who knows.
is.
And he said exactly as you said. He said, this makes absolute biological sense. He said, if I had a daughter who was pregnant and she accidentally took mifepristone and wanted to save her baby, I would give her progesterone and I would give her a high dose for at least a few days. And I'll tell you something, I bet you it would work. So when somebody, and he calls himself pro-choice, by the way. So when someone of his caliber, and his he's not he doesn't have a conflict of interest in that, he's not sort of staunchly pro-life, was prepared to come out and make that statement. And then I looked at the animal studies that had been done showing that progesterone given in time will reverse the effect or prevent the ongoing effect of mifepristone. Then I looked at the pilot studies, the small case studies. I looked at the safety issues and I saw, yeah, we got to go with this. So that's what convinced me in the end. Just the evidence was year by year just getting stronger and stronger. You probably know already more than almost 6,000 babies, about 5,500 plus, have been born already over the last 12 years to mothers who had taken mifepristone, regretted it, and managed to get progesterone.
That
So
is
more
beautiful.
than five now. So
That's
find out. In
incredible.
the UK, we have 62 that I'm aware of. I'm responsible for 29. I've got another girl. She's about 38 weeks. So within the next couple of weeks, I'll reach number 30. Hopefully, all going well. I have another few who are one. My earliest one. She's just coming up to 9 weeks, but she's been fine. She took the mifepristone very early at 6 weeks, 5 weeks and 6 days. She took mifepristone. She had a scan done the day she took the pill, and they said 5 weeks, 6 days. But she's doing fine. She had a little bit of bleeding for a couple of days, but she's had another scan done last week, and her baby's fine. Once she gets over the 2 weeks, and she's well, she's now coming up to 3 weeks over the mifepristone. She should be okay.
Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, Uju, I just wanted to ask on this point of on the success stories, I guess you mentioned thousands of women have been able to give birth to their child, to their children, because they took this very simple, very common sense medical I don't know, intervention, I guess you could call it
That's
that.
right.
From your experience, in speaking to these women, because you obviously have follow-up sessions and you meet with them, and what are their thoughts on this when you realize that, wow, I just dodged a huge bullet. I could have had my child killed, and here my child is here, and I'm a mom. And life may not be easy. It doesn't mean that there's no struggles, and life's tough. But in from your experience in dealing with these women, these moms, what do they have to say about this?
They are so grateful. I love. First of all, I love them all. They're all so loving. They made it. They know well. They made a desperate mistake, but they were so grateful that they had the opportunity to do something about it and save their baby. I haven't met all of them. I've only met five or six of them of the 29 that I've had. But there will be others I'll meet in coming. There's one girl in particular, and Uju may well know her, called Amrita, who's been very, very vocal because she is so so grateful for what happened, and she's gone on television and she's spoken at March for Life and she's spoken
Yes.
in Ireland and she's spoken on other podcasts about her experience as well. When she regretted what she did, she rang back the abortion provider who gave it to her, not BPAS or MSI, whichever one, and she said that she changed her mind and she wants to, and they said, yeah, well, just don't take the second pill, you might be okay. But she did, that wasn't enough, good enough for her. She wanted something more than that, so she went online and found abortion pill reversal, called them, and then they contacted me and we got in touch. Again, she had a little bit of bleeding for a couple of days, but her baby has done fine. Her little girl is doing. So she has become material. She referred another girl to me because another girl saw her story, having taken the mifepristone, regretted it, didn't know how to contact anyone, but saw Amrita's story and found her on Facebook, contacted her and said, the doctor who helped you, could you put me in contact with him? And she's had her baby as well. So word gets around, and the same thing happened with another girl, actually a girl who just had her baby a couple of weeks ago. She got in contact with me through the husband of another girl that I'd helped 2 years ago. when she regret, because again, she didn't know what to do, but she knew she'd heard about this other woman. She knew the husband, and the baby had been saved after she'd taken them. So she said, can you get me a contact? And I, out of the blue, I got a phone call from a stranger on a Saturday afternoon in December last year. And she said, I got your name from the husband of the lady who you helped. Can you help me? Because I've taken the mifepristone, and she had her baby just last week, or within the last 2 weeks. So word gets around, and but they're also grateful. Even the ones, because even the ones where it didn't work out, they're so grateful that somebody tried to help them. This came across in the statements we got from women. I mentioned that we got 10 statements from women for our legal case. We could have got 40, we could have got 50, but we got 10 because they felt we don't want to overload the judge or the tribunal with too much information. But let's get different stories. So we got two, I think, from women who'd had their babies and were so grateful. We got two or three from women who were still pregnant, but the process was ongoing and the babies were doing fine. We got a couple from women who had tried the treatment, but it didn't work. And we even got two from women who discussed it with me, but for various reasons decided not to go ahead with the treatment. We got these 10 different stories, and all of them, I was in tears as I read them, because I didn't know at that, because I wasn't allowed to interview the, I had to just give the information, ask them, is it okay if a legal person talks to you? Because I wasn't allowed to have any influence. And they all said, oh, yes, of course. But when I read the statements, I was in tears, because it had meant so much to them. Even the ones, one girl who, where it didn't work out, said that it restored her faith in mankind to think that people could be so kind to try to help her in her, we call it, in her darkest hour. And that was the sort of the gist of all of the levels of gratitude, that they were so grateful that somebody was there to help them, not only to me, but to Dr. Riley, to the nurses at Heartbeat International, to the various organizations who put them in touch with us. Because really, this shouldn't even be a story. This should be, a patient has a problem, a medical problem. They go to a doctor. The doctor gives them help as he or she is able to do and has the knowledge and experience and ability to do. And the patient comes out either with a good result, or unfortunately it hasn't worked out. That's all it should be. This shouldn't have ever have hit the headlines. You shouldn't be talking to me about this now. It should be a simple matter of, a woman had a problem, she went to a doctor gave her help, and her baby survived, or sadly the baby didn't. It was the pro-abortion people who decided to make an issue of this. They tried to make an example. They presumed, I can only think they presumed that this would go away, that we would be so scared that we wouldn't want to fight this. But actually, I have to thank Andrea Williams from Christian Concern, because that very first meeting on Zoom, my opinion, my attitude was, well, it's the DMC, there's nothing, they're so powerful, there's nothing we can do.
They're a
She pointed
giant.
her finger, she pointed at me on the Zoom camera, and she said, no. She shouted, no, we will not accept this. This is unjust. This is wrong. You're providing a wonderful service, an ethical service for these young women. We have to fight this. And she did. So I said, well, okay, if you think. So I was in their hands, really, and in the hands of the Lord
And
from there on in.
we thank you, Dermot, for fighting this and for being, for you and your colleagues, for being the ones who said, you know what, we're not going to get pushed around on this because this is a life-saving procedure and it works. And, just listening to the stories of these women who, it restored kind of like hope and humanity, and that there are people out there who are willing to help them. And I can't think, but, I've spoken to many women who have had abortions, and they regret their abortions, and it's a lifelong journey of healing and trying to overcome what they did. I can't help but to think that even if the procedure did not work out for some of these women, at least they know that yes, they made a mistake by taking that first pill, whether it was because they were forced into it or whatever. But the point is, they tried to fix it. They tried to save their child's life. And I think even though it doesn't work out, I have to believe that the level of hurt is probably not as great as it is for someone who just willingly went through it and killed their child.
And they didn't
Absolutely.
try to undo it. But just for the record, Dermot, we've talked about this GMC case and the investigation that they put you through for, what, 9 or 10 months. But just for the record, what was the outcome? Because you've talked about it, but I needed to go on record exactly, because I
Of
saw
course.
what the outcome was, but I want to hear it from you.
This is the exciting bit. So the penalties were imposed. We got information, we got all these witness statements, and we rushed them in. And then we were told that this was in May. Then in August, we said, oh, new information has come to light. We're going to have an earlier than planned review. And we thought, great, this is it. They're going to look at the evidence, and they're going to drop the conditions attached. But to our astonishment, and my legal team just threw up their hands in aspiration, basically, and called them a kangaroo court. The very first statement, even though all this evidence, and the reason for having the review was because of this new evidence, the very first statement from the mouth of the chairperson was that, of course, we're not going to look at any of the evidence. This is not to determine the veracity of the case. It's to purely see are the allegations still serious enough to warrant continuing the conditions. And at that stage, we thought we knew there was no point, but we went ahead. We went through the motion. We gave all the evidence, and they said, oh, thank you very much. And now we'll adjourn, and we'll come back with our decision. And the decision was decided in advance before they heard any of the evidence. So at that stage, that was August. So they decided, Christian Legal Centre decided, this is ridiculous. We're going to take this out of the, we're going to appeal to a proper court. We're going to take it out of the hands of the GMC and the Medical Tribunal. We're going to go to the High Court. So they issued a suit, like they sued. We basically, I sued the GMC. We put in a submission to the High Court saying that this was an unjust decision and giving our reasons why that this was unnecessary and without, because there was no evidence. That was the thing. There was no evidence.
For
All of the
sure.
evidence was on our side. They had no evidence. All they had was allegations and hearsay. So we put it forward. I thought it would take years because there was a long backlog of COVID cases, because of COVID cases. But surprisingly, our submission went in at the end of September, the start of October, and we were granted a hearing for the end of February. So we decided, great, at least we're going to get proper justice. In the meantime, there was another review in January, and the conditions were still upheld, so nothing was going to change there. At that point, the GMC actually, they got their own expert witness. This was a surprising thing because every few weeks we were getting emails to say, well, we're having difficulty finding an expert witness to back our side of the story. Now, we got one within 2 days, 3 days,
Yeah.
statement within a week. They had sort of 6 months and still nothing had happened. Eventually, they got one just after Christmas, December 2021, who gave them a statement. And surprisingly, because we were, the statement was sent to us, it was almost identical to our expert witness. It was quite supportive of what we were doing. They said, yes, there is an evidence base. It's not unethical. It's not unlicensed. It's not illegal. There's no evidence of any sort of pressure being put on these women. The only concern that their expert witness had was that there was an element of payment because some of the girls. Because this isn't a normal, it's not a normal NHS treatment. So I had to explain to them, unfortunately, you'll have to pay for the tablet. And the natural question is, how much is it going to cost? And it's about £20 for 2 weeks supply. I give 2 weeks at a time, so I don't want them spending a lot of money on something that may not be successful. So we get £20, if get a good start. And if they need more treatment, so I want to get them to 12 weeks. If they get to 12 weeks, they'll be fine. If they're already over 12 weeks, I just get 2 weeks of treatment. So some girls need 6 weeks treatment, some need 3 weeks, some need 2 weeks, some need 4 weeks. So it's about £20 for 2 weeks treatment. And most of the girls said, that's fine, I can sort that, I can manage that. So there
Twenty
was some
pounds.
evidence.
Abortions cost more.
So
abortions cost a lot
that's the
more in
trouble,
many
the abortion pills are
countries.
free. Abortion pills are free, so they that's an unplaying field, an unfair playing field to start with. So they don't have to worry about costs because the taxpayer pays for that. So some of the girls I said, is this the only reason why you're not going to go ahead with the treatment? Like, do you really want to go ahead with treatment? And is the lack of finance the only reason? Because if it is, I will gladly help you out with that. So in some cases, I did help with the girls. Now, we tried initially to pay the pharmacy, but pharmacies they wouldn't take money over the phone or over email. It had to come from the client. So I had then had to transfer money into her account, and she would then. So we were able to show that we're not actually paying the girl. So we weren't bribing them. We were just paying the pharmacy, but through her. And then they accepted. The expert witness accepted. Okay, that explains that. But otherwise, so their expert witness report came out. That was in January. And then I got a phone call on the 18th of February. So 6 days, 18, yeah, 6 days before the scheduled court appearance. In the meantime, we were looking forward to our day in court because we had lots of evidence and we were going to make all these statements. But I got a phone call from my barrister to say, have you heard the great news? They've dropped the case. And initially I was a little bit disappointed, but then I thought, well, that's great. That's wonderful. Half an hour later, I got an official email from the GMC to say, yes, we have decided. And they gave the reasons why. They had the full report. The conclusion was that having examined all of the evidence, including the witness statements and so on from the expert witnesses and from the mothers involved, and looking at the allegations, they concluded that there was no prospect of finding any evidence to support any of the allegations of professional misconduct, that the allegations that have been made whereby professional misconduct may have been, you know, positive. So the wording was there was no prospect of finding any evidence to go against us. Which is not a surprise, because there was no evidence, because obviously they didn't want to go to court, because I think if it hadn't been for the threat of the High Court, they would not have come forward so quickly. They would have just left it go on and on. It was interesting. I mentioned Eileen went with one of the secular insurance or defense groups, and they basically told her, okay, we know you're guilty, keep your head down, just don't say anything, don't challenge this, we'll see, can we have damage limitation. Now, that was their response basically to her. And they didn't drop the charges against her, weren't dropped until 2 months later. They couldn't keep the charges against her. They've already dropped them against me because we were doing the same thing. But interestingly, they were not in any rush to drop the charges against her. There was an urgency, because they would have had to go to court on the 26th of February. Okay, they would present their allegations, and then the judge would say, okay, now show me the evidence to support your allegations. And all they would have been able to say would have been, well, we don't have any evidence, Your Honor, but we don't like what that guy's doing. Clearly, that is all they would have had. They just didn't like what I or Eileen were doing.
Doctor, what makes me extremely mad about all of this is, of course, the sense of injustice and how much time and just your emotional and mental health and everyone around you and the toll that it took because of all this whole process. But all of this, this whole process started with Mary Stopes. That's it. That's the problem here, that it always comes back to the same organization, the same, you know, the abortion industry. Whenever they see good things happening, life being protected, life being saved, they get angry and they want to shut you down. They want to cancel you. It's like a character assassination as well, right? You know, anyone who's maybe not pro-life, or just the average person picking up the newspaper, reading the news, or looking at the news online or on TV, and they see this whole case of these doctors being persecuted, it's like, oh wow, they must be doing something bad, but really, you weren't. And ultimately, the problem with this situation is that Mary Stopes continues to do what they're doing, and they're still free to continue doing this, free to continue spreading these lies. And I remember, just maybe this was a year or two ago, at the same time while all this was happening, even in the Canadian Parliament, there was an MP, a member of Parliament, who blasted a pro-life group, Alliance for Life Ontario. Wonderful. That's it. Wonderful people.
I wrote her a nice letter.
Perfect. But you see, you have this pro-life organization who's promoting abortion per reversal, and then you have this member of parliament in the House of Commons calling it misinformation, disinformation. It's non-evidence-based. This is the situation that we're in. So I think you've given me a lot to think about, even here in the Canadian situation. Maybe we should pursue going after some of these lie spreaders, because they're spreading lies. They're spreading
misinformation, incredible misinformation. Just the last question for you here, Dr. Demo, because you've really taken time to go through like a range of issues surrounding this months that now we see, you know, chemical abortion completely, you know, kind of causing a havoc through the Western world, the way it's come in and the way it's made abortion a lot more prevalent. Many people, Matt had just earlier on been sharing some statistics with me, something like 60% of all abortions in the US are now chemical abortions, and even more than that in some of the Scandinavian countries. In the UK, I do know that during COVID, there was all this thing about the EMA, the emergency medical abortion, which they had decided to bring abortions by post for pregnancies, you know, if the baby is not up to 10 weeks of gestation. And then later on, 2 years later, in 2022, that was now made permanent. So the whole thing, it's really something that I think we may not even be thinking a lot about it, because of course, when we think of abortion, we're thinking of, pregnant woman, visibly pregnant, going into an abortion clinic and having this surgical abortion, which, of which that is only now is even a proportion of the larger problem just generally abortion in general, of which chemical and medical abortion is now a huge part of. Now, but I want to ask you about what Matt had alluded to earlier. People talking about it as if it's misinformation, non-evidence, with the kind of talk. Whenever you hear anybody in any country, be it Canada, be it UK, be it anywhere, especially in the Western world, anybody, any, just even a politician can talk about abortion reversal as if it's really out of medicine, like it's quackery, as we say in Nigeria, like this is not really proper medicine. But I think part of it is also in the fact that there are no public, like I was looking through the internet, just looking through some peer-reviewed journals, and I wasn't really seeing a lot of publications as I should have about this particular subject. It's almost like very few publications were being put out in support of abortion reversal. So can you talk a bit about that? How you see it from your own point of view, whether there's anywhere really where the publications are being made that we're not seeing, and if so, where? And then why aren't we having the publications if they're not there? Because it's being practiced. You're practicing it. There are some other doctors around the Western world who are practicing it. Where are our peer-reviewed journals that we can point to and say, this is really evidence, or this is really excellent medicine?
Yeah, there are a number of issues there. One of the problems is unfortunately, there is a strong editorial bias against pro-life work. So, and not only for abortion pill reversal, but if pregnancy centers that help women in pregnancy, they're going to find it difficult to any good things that they might do, especially if there's a medical element to it. They're not going to get that published in New England Journal of Medicine or The Lancet. So there is a definite, whereas if, people like Mary Stopes or anyone who's advocating for abortion pills, you'll get all sorts of very easily all sorts of papers published on how wonderful abortion pill is and how safe it is. And they've no idea how safe it is, because it's not safe, because they don't follow up. And we know that, I know that from the girls that I help, that none of them get any follow up from the abortion providers. They will only find about it if a problem arises, and even then they'll say, oh, so some of the girls have gone back to the abortion provider if they've had bleeding and said, oh, go to A&E, go to your ER department, or no, don't come to us, we're not going to be, or go to your GP, go to your family
That's
doctor. So
it.
they don't want to know, but they have no idea what the complication rate is. Well, we know the complication rate is at least as 1 in 17, so about 6 or 7% of serious complications, ones that as a result of taking the abortion pills, you end up in the emergency department or the A&E department because of serious infection, severe hemorrhage, or retained products causing ongoing pain, ongoing bleeding, and risk of serious infection. So there are at least 1 in 17 women who that we know this from Freedom of Information from ambulance trusts or ambulance services and NHS trusts, and it's possibly higher than that because they're the ones that admit that they've taken the abortion pill. Others might say, well, I'm having a miscarriage and it's not complete or whatever. So it's at least 1 in 17, possibly even higher than that. So there's no way the abortion people who publish their papers know the actual truth, but they've no difficulty getting their papers published. The one regret I do have about this, and I mentioned that people like George Delgado, Matthew Harrison, Mary Davenport should be nominated for a Nobel Prize, but I would have liked if 12 years ago, 14 years ago, 15 years ago, when they first came up with this idea, this theoretical idea that, well, progesterone might work because mifepristone blocks progesterone receptors. Maybe if we give progesterone, when they came up with this idea, but before we knew it would actually work, they probably should have tried to organize a randomized control trial. That's the one thing that people can truthfully say against us, that, oh, you don't have any randomized control trial to support your work. Not everything in medicine needs a randomized control trial. For example, most of the emergency resuscitation measures that we do, like cardiopulmonary resuscitation, defibrillation, there's no randomized control trial to support those, because they just have evolved over the years. people said, "Whoa, what if we do this? Maybe it'll help to save this person's life." And then it worked. And then they tried it again. It worked again. And then it became common practice. And it gets to a stage where it's happening so frequently that, you know, we can't not do it, and it wouldn't be ethical to not provide this life-saving treatment. And that's the way abortion pill reversal has worked. I would have liked if they had done some sort of randomized control trial. Now, that would have taken a long time, and the evidence may not have been able, we may not have been able to find the evidence, but I think that might have been helpful. So we don't have that. But what we do have are very good observational style study. One, the largest one published by George Delgado, 2018, but in a journal that is a peer-reviewed journal called Issues in Law and Medicine. But people say, "Oh, that's a pro-life journal," and it has a pro-life stance. But you could easily say the New England Journal of Medicine has a pro-abortion stance. So, but nobody criticizes them. So we're having difficulty getting our work published in neutral or journals that don't have any sort of particular bias one way or the other. So there is, mind you, there is an investigator in Australia, a guy called Joe Turner, who has managed to get a couple of publications, not strongly promoting abortion pill reversal, but at least enough to show that abortion pill reversal is safe. He's got a pilot study published in one of the, not one of the main, like it wasn't one of the main journals, but a small one of the small journals, but still a well-recognized peer-reviewed journal, published just earlier this year, with another doctor called Debbie Garrett. So there is some work going on, but these are small studies. I'm hoping this year I'm going to write up. I was hoping, because I've helped 140 girls have contacted me, or at least I've had 140 respond calls. Now, some of them were fake calls, I'm pretty sure, from maybe journalists or people trying to find out what I was up to. Some of them, the girls decided not to go ahead with the treatment. But some of them, when I get to about 150, I'm going to just write a case series, because that's a very valid way to get published. I've seen papers published in some of the high-ranking journals, such as the British Journal of Obstetrics, where just a case series of consecutive cases, so no bias attached. This is what happened. This is what the results were, and then a commentary maybe at the end. So I'm hoping that a case series like that, but over a long period of time, but a large number of cases, consecutive cases. So I'm not just cherry picking the good ones or the bad ones, which can happen when you just publish a small series. I'm just going, this is the truth. This is numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and up to 150. This is the outcomes. This number took part. This didn't take part. Give the reasons why if we know them. This was the successes. This were the failures. These were the side effects that they experienced. These were the bleeding rates. So I would just tell just a paint a full, truthful picture. So I'm hopeful
Excellent.
that type of study might get published in, not necessarily one of the high-ranking journals, but in a journal that we can't be accused, "Oh, that's just a pro-life journal." So
Yeah,
that's my aim, is to try and get that.
well, we certainly look forward to having this published and having you continue along these lines, and of course continuing your cardiology as well. Your medical practice, honestly, just listening to you and also what I've known about you before now, what I have to say is your medical practice is a gift. You know, it's a gift to so many, you know. So thank you so very much, Dermot, for your practice. Thank you for your saying yes. Thank you for your courage. You know, your courage in going ahead with this, even after that awful situation where an abortion organization reported you and tried to humiliate you. So we are grateful. And what I just, you know, my takeaway from this is excellent medicine. You know, this is actually genuine life-saving intervention, and so it should be allowed to continue, and so it should get publication. So I'm hoping that definitely when you write, it should get published. It should go to the Lancet. It should go to neutral grounds and big and well-reputed medical journals. So thank you so much. If there's anybody who is listening to this podcast, whether you're listening to it now that, you know, shortly after we've recorded, whether one is listening to me, whenever, my own is, you know, what I pray, I honestly pray and hope that somebody will somehow take the information to somebody who has made a mistake to take the first abortion pill. And then the person will get to realize, listen, abortion reversal is possible and is being practiced by, you know, by well-reputed doctors. So thank you so much. And may your
Uju,
work continue to be strengthened.
And Uju, what we'll do is we'll include the hotline number in our show
Yes,
notes.
definitely.
If do you know the hotline number, Dr. Rumit, right now, just off the top
I
of your
don't know it
head?
off by heart, but I know the website, so and that's how most of the girls find us. They go to abortionpillreversal.com. That's important to put in
Excellent.
the dot com, because if you just put in abortion pill reversal, the engines are full of the search engines are full of Mary Stopes and
Of
BPAS and
course,
Planned
of
Parenthood
course.
saying negative things. So abortionpillreversal.com takes you right to the heart of the helpline.
So there it is, abortionreversal.com.
Abortion pill.
Abortionpillreversal.com.
Abortionpillreversal.com. We will also include the hotline number. And again, if you're a parent, a grandparent maybe, and you have a young woman or you're not so young woman who is pregnant in crisis, has been duped into taking the chemical abortion drug, there is an option. There's a solution, and there are people out there willing to fight for their life and the life of their baby. So, Dr. Dermot Carney, we thank you so much for being part of this Focus on Life podcast with us today. It was great to see you in Ottawa this past May at the National March for Life. For those who haven't seen Dr. Speaking from the Hill, you can watch that on the March for Life YouTube page. His whole presentation is there, as well as at the Candlelight Vigil. And I'm sure we'll be hearing and seeing more of you in the near future. And
And
once
he's on
that,
X as well.
and
Can
very
you?
active
Yeah,
on X, very
quite.
active.
So he can give us his handle if he knows it as well.
It's just at Dermot Carney 3, I think.
Who are the other two?
I don't know. I don't know.
That's a
That's
wise crack.
just when I joined it, they gave me that number. So at Dermot Carney 3.
Dermot Carney 3, very, very active on
We'll
Twitter
put
or
a
on
link as
X. We'll
well.
put a
Yeah.
link to that.
Yeah.
Please follow him. And
Yeah, if you're interested in music or film, I do a lot of comments on films and music and things as well. So it's not only pro-life
of
stuff or
course,
abortion pill
we
reversal.
need the entire, of course.
Uju often makes fun of me because my ex, I do some pro-life retweeting and sharing, but a lot of it is just sports. So it's
Football.
really,
Of course.
us
That's a good thing.
pro-lifers, we actually have a very diverse range of
We have
personalities.
a life.
We are human beings with different interests. But yes, thank you so much, doctor, for being here with us. And we really appreciate you and your sacrifice. And please continue to pray for Dr. Carney and all the faithful doctors that are trying to do the right thing all around the world. And pray for all the women, especially those who are considering abortions. And for those who have taken that first pill, that first deadly pill, may they, through God's intervention, find themselves in front of the abortion pill reversal option so that lives can be
That's
saved.
good. Yeah, absolutely. Amen,
Great.
amen. Thank you.
Amen.
Wow. Thank
Wow, indeed, Uju. Wow, indeed. Dr. Dermot Carney, what an amazing physician, a real physician in the truest sense of the word.
Well, honestly, this is the real deal. And I don't know if I'm the right person to say this, but honestly, I've worked in the UK in a hospital, in different hospitals in fact, the UK for the last almost 20 years now. And I can tell you that this man, where he is at its level of practice of medicine, is so reputable that for somebody like him to just come and be so humble, like as we've heard him now, just speaking with him this let's say past hour, and also just having witnessed his courage and the fact that he's standing by the truth and he's really, kind of coming out for real life saving, for these kinds of real life saving procedures. It's for me, it's quite inspiring. It's
It's
quite inspiring.
inspiring, but also the sacrifice he had to take.
Yes.
He
Yeah.
really took one for the team, like
He
in a big
did.
way, him and his
Yeah.
colleagues.
Yeah.
But I'm so thankful to him for pushing back
Yeah.
with the power of some solid legal assistance with some
That's
lawyers.
right. That's
They
right.
pushed back, and the other side ended up giving up on their crusade against them, for all, and because there really is no evidence. There is
Yes, and a lesson as well. Eh? This is one case, but it can easily be replicated, and we can point out various cases and various times when this is modus operandi for the abortion industry. This is
That's
how
it.
they operate. They try to humiliate anybody who is outstanding in any way, as we see Dr. Dermot is outstanding, even for the fact that he's a reputable medical practitioner, he is a cardiologist, he's reputable, and that's really the more reason why they had to go after him. So anybody like that who comes out in any field at all, and you need to know the abortion industry will come after you. They will come after you. This is how they operate. But again, maybe we've learned just from speaking to Dr. Demert and from this particular episode, fight back. It's always good to pray and fight back and seek the right advice. But don't try. I know sometimes it's quite difficult, but try not to back out or back down.
That's right.
So I'm
That's right.
grateful. I'm grateful to Dr. Demert
Very
as well. That's
grateful. And
just
I even
grateful.
learned, I thought I knew a lot about chemical abortions. But I learned a
Oh,
lot
we've
about
learned.
just even the data that a doctor had just on hand, and all that he said about the abortion pill reversal, how it works, the impact it has on women, but also the women who end up losing their babies, even though they try to
They
save
try
them
to
through
reverse. I never
it,
really thought about that,
right? And
Rebecca.
but even their gratitude to the doctors who were there for them, saying, listen, we can do what we can. We don't know if it's going to work, but we'll try to save your baby. And that's something they don't get from the abortion provider, right? Like Dr. Carney said, they give them the pills and see you later. Have a
See you
nice life,
later. And even
right?
people who have gone to them to help, we've changed our minds. Again, that choice now does not come into play. They tell you, well,
Exactly.
go somewhere else. Allow it. Don't take the second pill. Whatever it is, but they're the ones who always have these gaps in their practice.
That's
So,
right. That's right.
all lessons learned.
All lessons learned. Anyhow, Uju, this was great conversation. Thank you for doing this episode again. It's been a long summer, and I think we're gonna try to kind of get back into the flow of things in the
We
fall.
hope so, but I must say this, I have two more travels coming up. I
Oh
will be
my
going
gosh.
to
Okay.
I'll be going to Budapest to speak, and I will be speaking at a natural womanhood event, which maybe in the next, perhaps in one of the following episodes, I'm sure we're going to talk about natural womanhood and all the amazing things they do.
Perfect.
But
Well, you know
yeah,
what,
but
Uju?
I
Good
look
luck with
forward to
that,
more episodes.
and I will continue speaking to the 5 or 10 people that show up at the various little meetings I go to, and all that is great, and I love it, and I'm happy you're having all these opportunities to spread the news and inform the world about what is happening. Okay. Well, thank you all for watching, or not watching, but for listening in. Make sure to go to focusonlifepodcast.com. It's our website. All the episodes are there. We are in the middle of season 2 now, Uju. This is, I think, episode 3, 4, or 5 of season 2. So we're getting there. You can email us your comments, your questions, any feedback at focusonlifepodcast@gmail.com. And I think that's it for me. So thank you for listening, and hopefully we'll be back soon.
Thank you, thank you.